Okay, let's begin again. I just missed one bottom bullet point there, so before we move on. That statement, typology is an effort to understand the unity of the Bible from the standpoint of history rather than allegory. And that diagram I had on here on that line of development of redemptive history and the same truth reappearing at various points along that line, you see the historical progression that ties that together. All right, let's go on to our next heading, which is Tabernacle is set up. Exodus 40. Remember when we talked about the structure of the book way back at the beginning of our discussion of liberation, or Exodus, Ben Sinai, Tabernacle, being the three key movements in the book. It's in chapter 40 where we reach that climax. You read verse 17, so the tabernacle was set up on the first day of the first month in the second year. And you read verse 20, took the testimony and placed it in the ark. Testimony is the Ten Commandments, those tablets of stone. And he brought the ark into the tabernacle, hung the shielding curtain, shield the ark of the testimony as the Lord had commanded him. And you read verse 34. Then the cloud covered the tent of meeting, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. Moses could not enter the tent of meeting because the cloud had settled upon it. The glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. I think when we looked at the instructions for the building of the tabernacle, there was a citation from J. A. Mokyr. It's on page 3132 of your citations. I don't want to go back and read that, but he says, this is the climax. This is, remember he said, God coming to dwell at number 10. God taking up residence in the midst of his people. The climax of this progress of redemption in the book of Exodus. All right, those comments then, and we'll move on to number 7 on your outline, the book of Leviticus. We're not going to spend a great deal of time in Leviticus. It's mostly legal material. You notice there are two subpoints under 7. A is the name. B is some general comments on content. As far as the name is concerned, you remember I said that in Jewish tradition, the name is taken from the first words of the first line of the book. And that happens to be Vayikra. In Leviticus 1:1, the Lord called to Moses. The Lord called, and he called. So in Jewish uses, in Jewish tradition, the title is, and he called. The title we are familiar with, Leviticus, comes from the Latin Vulgate. You can see the Latin form of the word Leviticus. It really means a Levitical book. A book that concerns the work of the Levites, especially the priests, and their duties. And I think we're better off having that Vulgate title as far as telling us something about the content of the book than the title in Jewish tradition, because Leviticus does reflect the emphasis of the book on ritual, duties of priests, duties of Levites, types of sacrifices, how they're to be brought, and so forth. General comments on content. The book is mainly ritual legislation. The historical framework for that is still Israel at Sinai. You notice how the first verse begins, the Lord called to Moses, spoke to him from the tent of meeting. So, at Sinai, Israel is being equipped for the purpose for which the Lord had made them a nation, going back to Exodus 19:6, where the Lord said, "You will be for me a kingdom of priests, a holy nation. Israel is to be set apart from all other nations. And Israel is to perform a priestly task among the nations, a mediatorial function." God had already given Israel a number of legal sections of legal material. You had first the foundation law, the Ten Commandments. Then you had the Book of the Covenant, Exodus 20 to 23. Then he went back up on the mount where he was there for 40 days. You've got all that regulation concerning construction of the tabernacle, Exodus 25 to 27. At the end of Exodus, the tabernacle's set up. And now in Leviticus, you have additional detailed instructions describing how a sinful people can approach a holy God and be assured of acceptance. That's, I think, the basic thrust of the book. How a sinful people can approach a holy God and be assured of acceptance. I think a key verse is Leviticus 17:11. I think I referred to this one other time. But 17:11 says, "For the life of a creature is in the blood. I have given it to you to make atonement for yourselves on the altar. It is the blood that makes atonement for one's life." So the fundamental idea of the book is substitutionary atonement. And that's provided by means of blood sacrifice. Another important feature of the book is that it regulates the duties of priests. Priests are necessary intermediaries between the Lord and his people. And I think the character of the book comes to light in 20:26, where you read, "You are to be holy to me because I, the Lord, am holy, and I have set you apart from the nations to be my own." So it's a book of the holiness of the Lord. The Lord is holy. He wants his people to be holy. His people are to be set apart from all other people. And if you look at the types of law, I'm going to just briefly point out five different categories of material. First, you have circumstances under which the sinner can and should bring a sacrifice. Secondly, you have the kinds of sacrifices he should bring, and instructions concerning how they are to be offered. Thirdly, qualifications and duties of priests are described. And fourthly, detailed laws concerning sexual chastity are given. I think that's to be seen particularly against the background of Canaanite practices in the area of sexuality. You find that especially in Leviticus chapter 18 and chapter 20, where you have detailed descriptions of things forbidden to the Israelites, which are said to be an abomination to the Lord. Don't do as the Canaanites do, they were told. And then fifth, laws concerning ritual cleanness and uncleanness. such things as no contact with dead bodies, leprosy, eating flesh from animals, etc. So it's those types of things that you find legislated in the book of Leviticus. It's a book of enormous significance for the ancient Israelite because it dealt with things that the Israelite was faced with every day of his life. In other words, as he went about his daily business, he would be confronted with the kinds of issues that are spoken to in these laws. Now, for us, I think the book takes on a quite different significance because we do not live under the Old Testament economy. These ritual laws are, again, of typological significance, pointing forward to Christ and find their completion and fulfillment in Christ. And as the book of Hebrews says, sacrifices, bulls and goats, all of them could not take away sin. It was only as they pointed forward to the sacrifice of Christ that that would be accomplished. And when Christ came, he was the final sacrifice. And all that has been prefigured and foreshadowed in these Old Testament rituals were fulfilled in Christ. And these regulations then are no longer binding on a believer in the new covenant. So for us, I think the meaning takes on quite a different shape than it did for the ancient Israelite. I think, first of all, we see in these laws the background for understanding references to sacrificial offerings, ceremonies of purification, institutions such as the sabbatical year, year of Jubilee, in the rest of the Bible. Some of that in the Old Testament, some of it in the New Testament. But if you want to understand those kinds of references, you find that the descriptions of such things are in the book of Leviticus. Secondly, you see Christ in a typical way in the Old Testament. All these rituals pointing forward to Christ. It's a book of atonement, sanctification, consecration, and those are certainly things of ongoing significance. Thirdly, it's of interest from the viewpoint of the general history of religions, where you can compare the worship of Israel with that of other ancient peoples. That's more a historical thing than a theological thing. But how did Israel worship? How did the Canaanites worship? How did the Egyptians worship? And you look at it from a history of religion standpoint. This is really where you get much of the information about how Israel worshipped in the Old Testament period. Lastly, as far as Orthodox Jews are concerned, there you have a meaning somewhat similar to what it was in the Old Testament, although the temple sacrifices aren't observed today. Much of it is, including dietary laws, the Sabbath. One commentator said, when asked what book of the Pentateuch they would like to study, most people of non-Jewish background would say Genesis text. Whereas the Orthodox Jew would probably say Leviticus, because in Leviticus there's all this material that governs how it goes about his daily life, still today. Other than those general comments, you notice on your outline, number 8, laws regarding sacrifice, Leviticus 1-7. I'm not going to look at that material, but that's where you get regulations on sacrifice. Number 9, consecration of priests. You find that in chapters 8 and 9. And I'm not going to comment on that either. But 10, I do want to make a couple brief comments. 10 is historical. It's the rebellion of Nadab and Abihu. And the way in which the Lord deals with that, this is one of the few narrative sections in the book. And you read in the first verse, Aaron's sons, Nadab and Abihu, took their censers and put fire in them and added incense, and they offered unauthorized fire before the Lord, contrary to his command. So fire came out from the presence of the Lord and consumed them. And they died before the Lord. Moses then said to Aaron, this is what the Lord spoke of when he said, among those who approach me, I will show myself holy. In the sight of all the people, I will be honored. Aaron remained silent. Moses summoned Mishael, Elzaphan, sons of Aaron's uncle, Uziel, said to them, come here, carry your cousins outside the camp away from the front of the sanctuary. So they came and carried them, still in their tents, outside the camp. Then Moses said to Aaron and his sons, Eleazar and Ithamar, do not let your hair become unkempt. Do not tear your clothes, or you will die, and the Lord will be angry with the whole community. Down to verse 8. Then the Lord said to Aaron, you and your sons are not to drink wine or other fermented drink whenever you go into the tent of meeting, or you will die. This is a lasting ordinance for the generation to come. So here is the story of Nadab and Abihu, who offer what is described here as unauthorized fire before the Lord. Exactly what that is not further described, and it's difficult to know exactly what the offense was. Some suggest that the coals that were put in their censers were not taken from the altar of burnt offering. See, if you go up to the last verses of chapter 9, you read in connection with the setting apart of priests, Moses and Aaron, in verse 24, the Lord appeared to all the people. Fire came out from the presence of the Lord and consumed the burnt offering and the fat portions of the altar. In other words, that altar at the end of the preceding chapter had been lit by divine fire, so to speak. It came from the Lord. Did Nadab and Abihu take some other source of coals rather than from the altar of burnt offering? If you go over to Leviticus 16, where you have the discussion of the Day of Atonement, and look at verse 12, it says there that Aaron is to take a censer full of burning coals from the altar from before the Lord, and two handfuls of finely ground fragrant incense. So it may have been the source of the fire. Others think it has to do with the incense. It says they added incense, and that maybe the incense wasn't made according to regulations, which go back to the book of Exodus. And it's Exodus 34 to 38, there are instructions for the making of the incense. Perhaps those instructions went by it. Weren't followed. But whatever it was, there was some either careless or deliberate breaking of prescribed regulations, and because of that, Nadab and Abihu were stricken by fire from the roof. Some also suggest there may have been drunkenness involved, because of that statement down in verses 8 and 9. You and your sons are not to drink wine or other fermented drink whenever you go into a tent of meeting where you would have come. Where Nadab and Abihu intoxicated and did something improper. But whatever it was, there was a very severe penalty. And I think, again, this may be a case of making an example out of Nadab and Abihu at the beginning of the ritual observance of Israel. At that beginning, it was important that their worship be established on a proper foundation. And an example be made when regulations are not followed. I think there's some parallel here with what happened with Nadab and Abihu, with what happened to Ananias and Sapphira in Acts chapter 5, where they misrepresented the offering they brought, and they were stricken and carried out. Certainly, other people subsequently did things as bad or worse than either Ananias or Sapphira or Nadab and Abihu, and don't pay for that with their lives, as these people did. But the Lord is again underlining in a very clear and forceful manner the importance of following these regulations when Israel is beginning their existence as God's covenant people. So that's a few comments on 10, rebellion of Nadab and Abihu. 11 is sort of just a catch-all, other laws, Leviticus 11 to 27. But you notice in parentheses, including the Day of Atonement in Leviticus 16. In all that legal material, certainly chapter 16 is an important chapter where annually you have this observance of the Day of Atonement. And on that day, the high priest made atonement for himself, for his household, and for the whole community of Israel. And it was an important day in the annual calendar, you might say, of ancient Israel and its worship. Besides 16, you might add there chapter 23, because in 23, you have reference to the three major annual festivals that were to be observed. You notice in 23:4-8, there's discussion of the Passover and unleavened bread. Verse 6, on the 15th day of the month, the Lord's Feast of Unleavened Bread begins. For 7 days you're to hold that. And verse 5, the Lord's Passover begins at twilight on the 14th day of the month, on the 15th. The Feast of Unleavened Bread. So the Passover and Unleavened Bread in verses 4 to 8. Then in verses 15 to 22, the Feast of Weeks. That is in the New Testament referred to as Pentecost. So from the day after the Sabbath, the day you brought the sheep of wave off and count off 7 full weeks, count off 50 days, that's where we get the Pentecost, up to the day after the 7th Sabbath, and description of that Feast of Weeks. And then in 33 to 43, the Feast of Tabernacles, or ingathering, that comes right after the Day of Atonement. So those three festivals, the Passover, the Feast of Weeks, the Feast of Tabernacles, were annual festivals that became very important in the life of Israel. All right, that brings us to 12. Preparation for leaving Sinai, Numbers 1:1 to 10:10. And A is the book of Numbers. And again, under Book of Numbers, I have two subpoints. One is name, two is content, and general remarks on content. As far as the name is concerned, in Hebrew tradition, the name is the Midbar in the wilderness. It comes from The first verse, the Lord spoke to Moses in the tent of meeting in the desert of Sinai, in the desert, beneath law. It's the fifth word in this case of the Hebrew text. The English name, Numbers, comes from the Septuagint, the Greek arithmoi, and then down into our English tradition, the translation of arithmoi, Numbers. Now, in this case, I think it's unfortunate that the title of the book's not from the Hebrew tradition in the wilderness, because in the wilderness tells you a whole lot more about the content of the book than does the title Numbers. If you read the title Numbers, and then you start the first chapter, and you have all these census figures, really it goes over pretty much over to the fourth chapter. And then chapter 26 at the end of the book, you have another chapter of census figures. But that's only five chapters. And as far as percent of the book, 90% of the book has nothing to do with numbers. So I think that the title In the Wilderness would probably help people, encourage them maybe to try to read the book much more than the title we're familiar with. As far as content is concerned, I think the way to get a handle on content is look at the chronological structure of the book. The book covers a period of 38 years. Israel was 2 years at Sinai, and then 38 years in the wilderness. We find that from comparing Numbers 1:1 with Deuteronomy 1:3. If you look at Numbers 1:1, you read, the Lord spoke to Moses in the tent of meeting in the desert of Sinai on the first day of the second month of the second year after the Israelites came out of Egypt. First day, second month, second year. And you look at Deuteronomy 1:3, and you read, in the 40th year, on the first day of the 11th month, Moses proclaimed to the Israelites all that the Lord commanded them concerning them. So, first day, 11th month, 40th year. So, Book of Numbers is covering a 38-year period. The Israelites were encamped at Sinai for about 2 years. We get that from Exodus 19:1, which says, in the third month after Israel left Egypt, they arrived at Sinai. And Numbers 10, verse 11, on the 20th day of the second month of the second year, the cloud lifted from above the tabernacle of the testimony, and that's where Israel sets out, leaving Mount Sinai. So they were at Sinai from the third month after the Exodus to the 20th day, second month, second year after the Exodus. But you see what that means is, let me go to the next one. Numbers 1:1 to 10:10 covers a period of 19 days. In other words, Numbers 1:1 would go back to that preceding text there in 1:1. First day, second month, second year. Numbers 10:11, 20th day, second month, second year. Numbers 1:1 to 10:11 is those last 19 days that Israel was at Sinai. That's basically the first 10 chapters. Of course, those census figures are part of that. They were organizing themselves to leave Sinai and do it in an orderly way by taking the census figures. They leave Sinai. The next significant event is described in 13 and 14, where they arrive at Kadesh Barnea, which is the very southern entrance, you might say, into the land of Canaan. And they send spies up into the land of Canaan from Kadesh Barnea. And the spies come back, the majority of them, except for Caleb and Joshua, say, there's no way we can go up and talk to these people. They're too powerful. And the Lord was angry with them, we read in those chapters, and therefore said, this generation who does not have faith and does not trust me to bring you into the land of Canaan will die in the wilderness. And the generation under 20 years of age that grow up in that wilderness period, they will be the ones who ultimately will enter the land of Canaan. So, Numbers 13 and 14, are the next significant event. Until you get to Numbers 15 to 20, which is the 38 years of wandering. In other words, only, what, 6 chapters of it. Tell you about that 38-year period. In other words, it's a pretty condensed description of that long period of time. How do we know that 20 is the end of that period of wandering? Because it appears that 20 verse 1 through 36, 13 is the last year, the 40th year after the Exodus. What's the basis for that? Look at Numbers 20 verse 1. Where you read, in the first month, the whole Israelite community arrived at the desert of Zin, and they stayed at Kadesh. There Miriam died and was buried. Now, the problem with 21 is, it says in the first month, but it doesn't say what year. I'm going to come back to that in a minute. In the first month, they arrived at the desert of Zin, stayed at Kadesh. Miriam dies and is buried. If you go down further in chapter 20, you read in verse 22 and following about the death of Aaron. You see, they arrived, they stayed at Kadesh. 22 says the whole Israelite community set out from Kadesh, came to Mount Hor. At Mount Hor, near the border of Edom, the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, Aaron will be gathered to his people. He will not enter the land I give the Israelites, because both of you rebelled against my command at the waters of Meribah. You read in verse 28, Aaron died there on the top of the mountain. Then Moses and Eleazar came down from the mountain. And when the whole community learned that Aaron had died, the entire house of Israel mourned for him 30 days. Well, if you go from Numbers 20, verse 1 and 22 to 29, where Aaron dies, to Numbers 33, 36, and following. Numbers 33 is a chapter that is a listing of all the places where Israel stopped as they wandered through the wilderness. And when you get to verse 36 in that list, you read, they left Ezi and Geber, camped at Kadesh, in the desert of Zin. Now, compare 36 with 20, verse 1. First month, the whole Israelite community arrived at the desert of Zin. They stayed at Kadesh. See, there's the desert of Zin, Kadesh. And then in 37, you read, they left Kadesh and camped at Mount Hor. That is the same as chapter 20, verse 22. All Israelite community set out from Kadesh, came to Mount Hor. And it's at Mount Hor where Aaron died. So you read in verse 37, they left Kadesh, camped at Mount Hor on the border of Edom at the Lord's command. Aaron the priest went up to Mount Hor where he died. And then you get a date again. On the first day of the fifth month of the 40th year after the Israelites came out of Egypt. So, that indicates that chapter 20 begins in the 40th year. So you go back to chapter 20, verse 1. In the first month, it comes to the desert of Zin. First month of what year? The question, what's that 40th year? Because that's where Miriam died and where Aaron died. So it seems clear then that from 20 verse 1 to 36 13, you have material pertaining to that last year, 40th year of the wilderness going on, the first year of the fifth month of the 40th year. So I think that helps, if you trace this chronology, it gives you a structure for the book. 15 to 20 is really the bulk of that period. First 10 chapters are Israel at Sinai, and 13 and 14 there are Kadesh, and fifteen to twenty is the wilderness wandering, 30 years. Okay, let's go on to B. The men of war numbered and positioned as such. 1:1 to 2:24. The Lord told Moses to take an inventory, and that involved counting all the males 20 years and older able to go out and fight. And you read that in the first chapter, verses 2 and 3, where the Lord says, take a census of the whole Israelite community by their clans and families, listing every man by name one by one. You and Aaron are to number by their divisions all the men in Israel 20 years old or more who are able to serve in the army. And the rest of chapter 1 describes how many such fighting men there were in each of the tribes. When you get down to verse 46, you get a total where the number from each tribe is added up. And you read in 46, total number was 603,550. Similar census is taken at the end of the book, in chapter 26. And if you look there at verse 51, the total number was 601,730. So almost the same, few less. But over that 38-year period, one generation's died, another generation's taken their place. But 600,000, round number, of fighting men age 20 or above. Now, if you extrapolate from that, if there are 600 fighting men age 20 or above, you have males who are less than 20, and you also have females. So for total population of Israel at the time of the Exodus, you would multiply that 600,000 by 3 probably, certainly more than 2, 3 or 4. So if you multiply it by 3, you're talking of almost 2 million people, 1,800,000, 2 million. Usually the round numbers given for a population of Israel are 2 to 3 million people. And that high number of people has raised a lot of questions, and not only by people who may not view the scripture as inspired and trustworthy account of the the history of this period of time. Some of the questions arise out of the text in the Old Testament itself with respect to how many Israelites there were. For example, Deuteronomy says over and over again something to this effect. Look at chapter 7 of Deuteronomy. First verse. When the Lord your God brings you into the land you are entering to possess and drives out before you many nations, the Hittites, Girgashites, Amorites, Canaanites, Perizzites, Hivites, Jebusites. Then the next phrase. Seven nations larger and stronger than you. Were there seven nations in Canaan larger and stronger than the Israelites? If the Israelites were 2 or 3 million people? That's repeated numerous times in Deuteronomy. Go down to verse 17. You may say to yourselves, of chapter 7, you may say to yourselves, these nations are stronger than we are. How can we drive them out? They have an army of 600,000 people. Go to 9:1. Hear, O Israel, you are now about to cross the Jordan, go in and dispossess nations greater and stronger than you, with large cities that have walls up to the sky. The people are strong and tall. 11:23. Then the Lord will drive out all these nations before you. You will dispossess nations larger and stronger than you. So you have phrases like that. If you go back to Exodus 23:29, you have another interesting statement. There you read, the Lord says of the Canaanites, Hittites, Hivites, I will not drive them out in a single year because the land would become desolate and the wild animals too numerous for you. Sounds like Israel's population wouldn't be large enough to manage the country, keep all these things under control. So the Lord says, I'm not going to drive them out immediately. So questions have been raised about how to understand these census figures. I think there are three basic approaches to interpretation of the numbers. And let me make some comments about each and then come back to a larger question. The first approach is those who accept the numbers as they are translated in our English Bibles on the basis that the way in which those numbers are translated in our English Bibles are the most apparent meaning of the Hebrew terms and words that are used in the original text. If you look at your citations page 41, I have two representatives of that viewpoint. We seem to be missing 41. Bottom of the page, McRae, the large numbers in this census have created difficulty for some readers who find it hard to believe the nation of Israel was so numerous during its march through the wilderness. Yet when we consider the large families that were customary length of time and so forth, the amount of increase to be seen is not unreasonable. That is a commentary by McRae in the New Bible Commentary. You go over to page 44, E.J. Young takes the same viewpoint. He says the total 603,000 in that first paragraph of Fighting Men. He says, three objections to these chapters have been made. If the number of fighting men was about 600,000, total population, then they'd be 2.5 million. Then impossible for 70 families will multiply this rapidly. He says it's not impossible because of the fruitfulness of the Hebrews. And secondly, the wilderness couldn't have sustained such a great group of people, but as he argues, it was the miraculous gift of manna, the Lord sustained them. And the order of march would be impossible. He says, but if the account was so impossible, no writer would have devised such an impossible scheme. Very difficult involves, but an indication of historicity. Since so little is said about the details of the march, there are no conditions across the historicity and accuracy of the statement. So there are numerous evangelical scholars who support the numbers as they stand, as they are translated in our English version. Second way to approach these numbers. This is a pretty typical critical view in which it would be said there is no value in the numbers at all. They are artificially contrived and completely untrustworthy. Usually, the argument is that this reflects a much later time. The numbers are exaggerated, of no historical significance. One commentator says they have no statistical value whatever. So some accept them as they stand translated. Some say they're of no value whatever. Third category. There are those who do not accept the numbers as translated in our modern versions, but attempt to find some explanation for them based on an alternate understanding of the meaning of the original text. In other words, those of this viewpoint would say there's something going on here in the original text that we don't fully understand, and the way they are translating our modern versions represents something other than a proper translation of the original language of the text. Now, of that category, some advocates of this viewpoint would be evangelical scholars who accept the trustworthiness of the text. Some would not. Some would be more critical scholars. If you look at the history of the interpretation of these numbers, in this latter category, long ago, a man named Flinders Petrie, who was one of the early archaeologists of the ancient Near East, pointed out that the Hebrew word eleph has two meanings. Eleph can be translated thousand. You have that elephim there, the plural of it, on the overhead. But eleph can be translated thousand. But it can also be translated as tenth group, or clan, something of that sort. Look at Judges 6:15. In Judges 6:15, this is the story of Gideon. Gideon says to the Lord, "How can I save Israel? My clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and I am the least in my family." When Gideon says, "My clan is the weakest in Manasseh," that's the word eleph. Some sort of a tribal subunit. You go to 1 Samuel 10:19. You read there, "But you have now rejected your God who saved you out of all your calamities and distresses. And you have said, 'No, set a king over us.'" This is an assembly of Mizpah. So now present yourselves before the Lord by your tribes and clans. Clans there is Elohim, the plural of Elohim. So Flinders Petrie looked at texts like that, where Elef did not mean thousand, but had some other meaning, like some sort of a tribal subgroup of some sort. He called it ten groups. And so what he did with the numbers that are given in Numbers 1 for each of the tribes, say, for example, verse 35, let's just pick one, where it says, the number from the tribe of Manasseh was 32,200. If you look at the Hebrew text, that's 32 Elohim. And two Me'oths, or hundreds. So he would say the Elohim refers to tent groups, the Me'oth refers to number of fighting men in a tribe or a tent group, or in a tribe, number of fighting men in a tribe. So that in this case of Manasseh, there would be 32 tent groups, Elohim, and there would be 200 fighting men. And he worked that down through all these numbers. So he concluded there were 598 tent groups, if you add all them up, in which there were 5,550 fighting men. In other words, about 9.5 fighting men per tent group. But he admitted that he really can't handle all the numbers in that way, because this really doesn't explain verse 46, where you get 603,550. It doesn't work with it. And also, for example, in 322, of Numbers, where you have the number of all the males a month old more counted was 7 Elohim, 7 tent groups, in which there were 500. In other words, the ratio seems out of proportion. 7 tent groups, 500. So that was one suggestion that hasn't really taken hold very much. R.E.D. Clark came up with another idea. He took that same root, the Aleph Mamet Peh, but pointed it differently, and instead of Aleph, pointed it Alu, which means chief or captain. So that in the numbers, you would have a certain number of captains, and then in the hundreds part of the number, you would have the warriors. A different or kind of modified form of that theory was worked out further by John Wenham. If you look in your bibliography, in the Tyndale Bulletin, he wrote an article on large numbers in the Old Testament. If you look at your citation, page 42, bottom of the page, and over to 43, there are a few paragraphs out of Wenham's article on large numbers in the Old Testament. And you notice it begins, there are various ways of taking Aleph without involving impossibly large numbers. Could be a social unit, family clan, tent group, or such group organized as a military unit, or it could be an officer, as Clark maintained, or a specially trained warrior, as our study of Judges 20 suggested. And he kind of goes with that idea I don't want to read all this. It gets very complex and detailed. You might want to get the whole article and read it sometime if you're interested in this. But notice the middle paragraph, page 43. There are reasons for thinking that the captains of thousands might normally have had seven or eight May oath under their command. Similarly, the actual strength of an average Mayah, do I have one? Yeah. He takes the May oath as military units. Similarly, the actual strength of an average Mayah, that's 100, might have been about 75 men. 235 and a half Mayoth of 75 men each would give 17,662 and a half men in all. This together with 580 Harutim would give a total fighting force a little over 18,000. And then he says we double this and prove when we get a figure about 72,000 for the whole migration. That's his bottom line. He, the way he works this out and the way he translates his words, he comes out with about 72,000 population, 18,000 fighting. So there have been various attempts made to deal with these numbers. I don't think any of the suggestions are totally convincing. They don't fit all the data. They particularly don't fit the summary statements that you find in the text. I think with a lot of the difficulties cited with the numbers, I don't think they're insuperable. You know, the logistic thing of particularly how could 2-3 million people survive in the wilderness of Sinai for all that time? Well, God provided for it in miraculous ways. I don't think that the number was something that could not have been attained during the time of Joseph's entry into Egypt and the Exodus. You have that 400-year period. They could have multiplied to that extent. It seems to me that where the problem lies, and I think there is a problem here, is with those biblical texts we looked at. Seven nations greater and mightier than you. And then in addition, what we know about the size of cities and the population of Canaan at the time of the conquest. If you look at the size of the cities, take Jericho, for example, first city they took. How big do you think Jericho is? Anybody have any idea? You know, it's pretty, it's a mound, and the walls of the foundations are still there. You can see where they live. 7 acres. In other words, it's a city about the size of the property with this school system, parking lot, and the front. We wouldn't call that a city. Now, that was admittedly a smaller city. There were about 2,500 inhabitants in Jericho. What can be told? Lachish was 18 acres, Gibeon 16, Megiddo 13, Ai 27 acres. So you're talking about pretty small settlements. Jericho, population 2,500 people. Look at page 42 of your citation. Roland DeVoe, in his Life and Institutions of Ancient Israel, says, the towns of the Bible were not large. It's astonishing to see from excavation just how small they were. Most of them could easily be fitted into Trafalgar Square. Some would scarcely fill the courtyard of the National Gallery. The annals of Tiglath-Pileser give a list of the towns of Galilee conquered in 732. The number of captives varies between 400 and 650. And this king used to deport entire populations. They were then villages like those today, no bigger. Next paragraph. From Samaria and Jerusalem, other source of information, Bill Sargon says he carried off 27,000 persons from Samaria. Next paragraph, for Jerusalem, the figures of Nebuchadnezzar's deportation is difficult. Reasonable estimate. In our Lord's time, the city had about 25,000 to 30,000 inhabitants. a few years ago, this was just the population of the old city within the walls, roughly the same space. Population 10 now has been much bigger than Old Testament times. So these cities were small. In the battle between Ramesses II and the Hittites, we talked about that in connection with the Hittite treaties and also in connection with the exodus of Ramesses with the Pharaoh of the oppression. According to Breasted, the ancient records of Egypt, the armies were about 20,000 of the Hittites and the Egyptians. Well, now, if the Hittites and Egyptians had armies of 20,000, did Israel have an army of 600,000? You go back to that Exodus 18 chapter, where you remember Jethro gave Moses the advice to appoint judges over thousands, hundreds, fifties, and tens. If Israel had 2 million people, which would be a minimum of 600,000 fighting men, 2 million people, and you think about what Jethro told Moses to do, if he implemented that, like it says he did, he would have had to appoint 2,000 rulers of 1,000 for 2 million, 20,000 rulers of 100, 40,000 rulers of 50, and 200,000 rulers of tens. So he would have made 262,000 appointees. And then you think Moses was doing all that work himself before he appointed these people. So that's just an attempt, you see, from Exodus 18 to work out the system that's spoken of there on the basis of a 2 million population. And then you wonder again, is there something going on in these census figures that we don't fully understand? That's where I'm inclined to come down on this. I see my time's running now, so I have to kind of... There's a Latin phrase called non requet, something on which you cannot speak because you do not have sufficient evidence to formulate a firm conclusion. I think this is an area where more work needs to be done, but more importantly, more work. I think more light has to be thrown on what's going on in these lists of numbers. I don't think the presently suggested ways of dealing with the text are adequate. If you look at page 41, is that the page I was missing? Yeah. There's one there, a paragraph there from R.K. Harrison towards the bottom of the page. He says, none of these attempts to scale down the Old Testament numbers is able to account satisfactorily for all the data involved. And hence the suggestions made cannot be taken as uniformly valid for purposes of interpretation. If other evidence from Near Eastern sources concerning numbers generally is of any value in this connection, it would apply the Old Testament numerical computation. Here's the crux of it. Rest on some basis of reality, which was quite familiar to the ancients, but which is unknown to modern scholars. I think that's probably what's going on here. Questions, comments? We're running out of time. I think whatever the text says, I think it's reliable. I'm not sure we understand the language there correctly, particularly with this use of this Aleph and Meholth. In other words, that Aleph and Meholth, it seems to me there's military significance to those terms. Is it commanders and military units or something of that sort rather than a strict numerical kind of equivalence for thousands and hundreds? I think there's something going on there that's not fully understood. That being the case, it's very difficult to say how many. It was enough that made the Egyptians concerned that they were getting too big to control. But on the other hand, it doesn't seem reasonable to me to think that Israel had an army of 600,000 and Egypt had an army of 20,000. So I think the text is reliable. I think there's something going on here that's